the Mary Cook, who works at EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, where she is a physical scientist there. Mary has been working with FFRO since 2006 and has been a subject matter expert for emerging contaminants such as PFAS. She's also worked on MPL site assessment and base realignment closure, or BRAC. She joined the federal government back in 1998 as a NPL and BRAC remedial project manager in EPA Region 3. We will also be joined by a second speaker, Emmy Laha, who's been here for the entire session. And she is an environmental scientist who assists in the Superfund federal cleanups of hazardous waste sites to the EPA Federal Facility Restoration and Reuse Office in D.C. And working in that office, she works on implementing national policy, promoting consistency in cleanups, developing training materials, and developing relationships with other federal agencies and stakeholders. So I'm going to go ahead and call up a quick session overview so that we can talk a bit about how the series is working for those of you who may be joining us for the first one. And I'll go over to Emmy to start that. Emmy?
Sure. So just a quick few moments to spend on our Federal Facilities Academy, which is something that the FFRO office has rolled out this year, and we're very excited. It consists of 12 courses overall, 11 webinars, one of which you're participating in today, as well as an in-person course. So if you participate in all of the webinars, remembering that you could also view the archived versions of webinars if you missed one of the first two, and then you are able to complete the in-person course, you can receive a program certificate of completion. And that's a way for EPA to recognize all the individuals who work on federal facility cleanups and those who are putting in the extra effort to understand how we conduct cleanups under Superfund at federal facilities in striving for that national consistency. So up on your screen, you see the list of courses that are coming up as well as those that have already passed. And we encourage you to participate in those that interest you, all of them, just a few of them, whatever works best for the cleanups that you're participating in.
Okay, thank you, Emmy. And I will also go on record here just to make this a bit more clear. As Emmy just mentioned, this is a multi-part series. There are 11 online webinars that are open to the public and one in-person classroom delivery that does have a limited audience. So for those of you who are able to attend the online webinars, these will all be online, or you can replay the recorded version. These are open to the public, and it doesn't matter how you attend, whether you're there live for all of them, you replay all of them as recorded versions, or some mix and match of those combos. For the in-person training, however, that will only be available through a classroom delivery, and you must attend that in person. That particular session has yet to be scheduled, but it will be open only to EPA states, tribes, and other federal agencies. Now, if you participate in those online webinars, again, whether it's live or by replaying a session, you'll be able to get a certificate for each webinar that's delivered online, so up to 11 individual webinar certificates, and you'll get one of those certificates upon completion of our online feedback form. So I'll remind everybody how they can fill out that form when we're done with today's session. If you are able to get a certificate for all 11 of the online sessions, again, whether they're in person live or you attend them live when they're online or you replay a recorded version, and you also attend the in-person classroom training, you're part of that limited audience, you'll then get a certificate for the entire series. So you have to complete all 12 parts, the 11 online and the one classroom delivery to get the Academy certificate. Otherwise, you can get a certificate for each of the 11 sessions that we're offering online. So I think, I think that's all that I'll cover now for those opening instructions. And why don't we get right started with our materials? So I'm going to pull up the presentation content and transition over to our very first speaker. So Mary Cook is on the line. Mary, are you there?
I am.
All right, Mary, feel free to get started.
Okay. Well, good morning or good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Records of Decisions and MORT Federal Facilities. The purpose of this course is to discuss how early and interim actions, explanation of significant differences or ESDs, the Records of Decision amendments or ROD amendments, and adaptive management can be used at federal facility sites listed on the NPL National Priorities List in accordance with CERCLA. It's important to remember as we go through this course that what we're focusing on here is federal facility sites that are on the NPL. We are not focusing on non-NPL sites at this time. So Jean pulled up, had up before we started, a group poll. Thanks for pulling that up, Jean. Besides a record of decision, or ROD, what other types of cleanup decisions have you been involved with as part of the CERCLA process? And see a number of answers here. Ooh, I didn't expect to see Rick or Mods. That was good. But we're going to cover a number of these during this course. The record of decision is the primary or critical milestone in the CERCLA process, but there are a number of other types of decision documents that can be used as part of this overall remediation plan. And I see that many of you are familiar with quite a few of the ones we're going to be touching on here today. To give you a course overview, in this course, Emmy and I will be discussing how a variety of decisions or paths forward can be used in federal facility Superfund cleanups. Again, I'd like to emphasize that we're only talking about NPL sites. Very briefly mentioned early actions, such as removals, and interim actions. Interim actions are where the decision is made to take quick action to protect human health and the environment from an imminent threat while we're working on a final remedial solution. Sometimes they're also to institute a temporary measure to stabilize the site or an operable unit to prevent further migration. We'll go into more detail about explanation of significant differences, or ESDs, the ROD amendments, adaptive management we'll be touching on as well, and we'll also be discussing the impacts five-year reviews can have on a remedy at a site. A key question to ask is, how can cleanup decisions complement each other to support the overall remediation goals for a site? These are not necessarily standalone components. Each aspect of the cleanup process that you see here and corresponding decision documentation can provide a piece of the puzzle in meeting those goals. And we encourage your cleanup teams to look at how they can all work together and how they can use these different tools. So, pseudo quick introduction to CERCLA. CERCLA, or the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, we also hear it referred to as Superfund, was enacted by Congress in 1980. And this law provided a broad federal authority to respond directly to releases or the threat of releases of hazardous substances that may endanger public health or the environment. CERCLA established prohibitions and requirements concerning closed and abandoned hazardous waste sites. It provided for liability of persons responsible for the release of hazardous waste at these sites, and established a trust fund to provide for cleanup, but no responsible party could be identified. CERCLA also enabled the revision of the NCP, or the National Consistency Plan. The NCP is the federal government's blueprint for responding to both oil spills and hazardous substance releases. The NCP is a result of efforts to develop a national response capability and promote coordination among the hierarchy of responders and contingency plans. And CERCLA was amended by SARA, or the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, in 1986. In 1987, the President signed the Executive Order, or EO 12580, and this delegates presidential authorities under CERCLA to heads of various executive branch agencies, or what you'll hear us refer to as lead agency. And you'll see in a number of the slides as we go forward, lead agency is highlighted in your slides. And we'll go into that in the next slide as to why that's specific to federal facilities. So with these executive branch agencies or the lead agencies, under certain circumstances, are the lead agency at the site under the Executive Order 12580, and EPA provides oversight in accordance with the Federal Facility Agreements, or FFAs. 12580 delegates authority to executive agencies to respond to releases in particular situations, such as initiating studies and investigations of releases on or from a facility under the jurisdiction, custody, or control of that federal agency. Select remedial actions at non-NPL sites, they can also conduct removal or remedial actions. And this executive order specifically and deliberately does not delegate remedial selection to other federal agencies. It is silent on that for the most part, but it does specifically leave that responsibility to the administrator or EPA. So you heard me mention lead agency and how this is different for federal facilities. The National Oil and Hazardous Substance Pollution Contingency Plan states that the cases where another federal agency besides EPA serves as a lead agency. And you'll see these on your slide. The lead agency is the agency that provides the on-scene coordinator, or OSCs, RPMs, to plan and implement response actions under the NCP. In the case of a release of hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant, where the release is on or where the source of the release is from any facility or vessel under the jurisdiction, custody, or control of DOD or DOE, then DOD or DOE will be the lead agency. And in the case of a release on or the source of a release from any facility or vessel under the jurisdiction, custody, or control of a federal agency other than EPA, the Coast Guard, DOD, or DOE, then that agency will be the lead agency for remedial actions and removal actions other than emergencies. The definition, as defined in the NCP, is very specific, what roles and responsibilities are. Please click. There we go. So CERCLA Section 120 in federal facilities. CERCLA 120 discusses CERCLA's applicability to federally owned or federally operated facilities. It states that federal agencies are subject to CERCLA to the same extent as a private entity. With certain exceptions specified in 120, each federal agency shall be subject to CERCLA to the same extent as a private entity, including liability. Federal agencies shall comply with all guidelines, rules, regulations, and criteria related to removal and remedial actions and shall not adopt guidelines inconsistent with those established by the EPA administrator. When a federal facility is not on the NPL, state laws concerning removal and remedial actions, including state laws regarding enforcement, apply to federal facility actions as long as the state law is not more stringent for federal facilities than for private facilities. In addition to making federal facilities subject to the same CERCLA mandates that apply to private parties, Section 120 imposes additional requirements on federal facilities. Excuse me. CERCLA also contains a waiver of sovereign immunity to permit individuals and states to bring citizen suits if an agency is not adhering to a CERCLA mandate. Oh, I went too fast. As I mentioned earlier, Executive Order 12580 designates authorities under CERCLA to the heads of various executive branch agencies. One very specific exception to that remedy is remedy selection, like I mentioned earlier, and that gives the administrator of EPA final say over the remedy selection in the first instance. So, CERCLA remedial actions are intended to provide a permanent solution to contamination that presents an unacceptable risk. CERCLA indicates a preference for treatment as opposed to leaving contamination in place, unaddressed, or relying strictly on land use controls, and remedies should use treatment technologies to the maximum extent practicable. As we mentioned in the earlier slide, removal actions and interim actions can be used as part of an overall cleanup strategy for a site. However, these interim actions must be followed by final remedial action. And in this course, we'll be focusing on the activities that occur in addition to the ROD and prior to the deletion from the NPL, mainly the blue bubbles that you're seeing here. We'll also be discussing the yellow adaptive management or the orange adaptive management in a later slide. So that is a sort of a quick CERCLA background, and we'll be moving right into removal actions, unless there are any questions immediately on those first eight slides.
So I'll just remind the audience that there's a Q&A window in the lower right corner where you can privately send in your questions and comments. I do see one that came in reference to slide number 6. And so, Mary, this participant wanted to know, how is the maximum extent practicable defined for use of treatment technologies?
Lindsay, that's a very good question. We can get back to you on that. I don't have that definition or a lot of detail with me for treatment technologies.
Yeah, this is Amy. We go a little bit into that in some of the follow-up slides where we just talk about maximum extent practicable, what that means, how it is considered. So we'll touch on it, maybe not to the level of detail that all will find satisfactory, but we'll talk more about it in a few.
Great. Thank you, Emmy.
Okay. All right. I don't see any other questions, so we can carry on.
Awesome. Thank you. So now we're going to talk about removal actions. In order for the lead agency to make a determination that a removal action is warranted, the lead agency must first make the determination that there is a release or threat of release into the environment of a hazardous substance or release or threat of release into the environment of a pollutant or contaminant which may present an imminent and substantial danger to public health or welfare. Removal actions may also be conducted to respond where there's a finding of actual or threatened release of hazardous substance. And in addition, removal actions may address short-term threats that are part of a long-term remedial response. There are three types of removal actions: emergency response, time critical, and non-time critical responses. Emergency removals require an immediate response to releases or threatened releases to the environment. Emergency removals are initiated within hours or days of the determination of that removal, determination that a removal action is appropriate. There's time critical removals, and these are situations where a removal is appropriate and on-site removal activities must begin within 6 months. And we have non-time critical removals, and these are undertaken when a removal action is appropriate and the situation allows for a planning period of at least 6 months before on-site activity must begin. So the administrative record file for time critical removal actions and emergency responses should be made available for the public no later than 60 days after the initiation of on-site activity. Public comment period should be held in an appropriate situation at the time the record file is made available and should be no less than 30 days. Although the signing of the action memo, which is the main document that we use here, generally signifies the completion of the response selection decision making, documents relevant to the response may be added to the record file later in certain situations than is described in the NCP. Where we have a planning period of at least 6 months, the NCP establishes important additional requirements for the use of removal authority, principally by requiring that an engineering evaluation or cost analysis, or what we call an ECA, be prepared, and by establishing significant public participation requirements. For non-time critical removal actions, a public comment period of at least 30 days is required on the ECA, and any supporting documentation at the time of the ECA is made also available for public comment. The administrative record file is made available for public inspection at the same time the ECA is made available. Under environmental-related removal actions, EPA is responsible for reviewing and approving sampling and analysis plans for environmental media such as soil and groundwater. This authority is not delegated to the lead federal agency. We get questions often about EPA's role in the sampling and analysis plan, and this authority, like we state here, is not designated to the lead federal agency, and it should be brought to EPA for comment and approval. The NCP further states that if environmental samples are to be collected, the lead agency shall develop sampling and analysis plans that shall provide a process of obtaining data of sufficient quality and quantity to satisfy data needs. In accordance with the NCP, SAPs shall be reviewed and approved by the EPA. And this includes SAPs for environmental-related removal actions implemented at federal facilities. EPA's 2001 guidance Requirements for Quality Assurance Project Plans, QAPs, states that for programs or projects of long duration, such as multi-year monitoring programs or projects using generic QA project plans, the QA project plans shall be reviewed at least annually by the EPA project manager. When revisions are necessary, the QAP must be revised and resubmitted for review and approval. Implementation of the Uniform Federal Policy for Quality Assurance Project Plans, or UFP at federal facilities hazardous waste sites, provides guidance for all data collection at federal facility hazardous waste sites. And you have a link on this slide, and you'll have information in the notes sections of these presentations to go into more detail about the UFP CRAP. So accelerating circular environmental restoration at federal facilities. This slide refers to the ETA guidance titled Accelerating Circular Environmental Restoration at Federal Facilities. 1994, the purpose of this guidance is to encourage and support efforts at federal facilities to accelerate and develop streamlined approaches to the cleanup of hazardous waste. It was signed by EPA, DOD, and DOE. In addition to considering the NCP, decision makers should also consider additional factors in determining whether to employ a non-time critical removal action or remedial action in certain situations. You're going to be evaluating the time sensitivity of the response, the complexity of both the problems to be addressed and the action to be taken, the comprehensiveness of the proposed action, and likely the cost of the action. The 94 guidance encourages evaluating potential areas for streamlining and accelerating the cleanup process, which include the use of removal actions to address imminent and substantial endangerment. And the use of non-time critical removal actions and interim response actions are identified in this document. It also encourages the use of non-time critical removal actions that will achieve results comparable to a remedial action, but can be completed in less time. So when developing a path forward, it's critical to remember that CERCLA 120 and Executive Order 12580 establish unique requirements for federal facilities and encourage the potential or cooperative decision-making between the lead federal agencies, EPA, and the states, and also keeping in mind consultation with the community groups. So I now turn you over to Emmy for removal action guidance and non-time critical removal action.
Awesome. Thank you, Mary. I think we might have had one or two questions come in on the slides we just reviewed. Jean, is there anything we should address before we start on this next section?
Yeah, we did have a few questions that came in. And so specifically, one participant wanted to know if EPA is required to review health and safety plans as well.
So Mary, correct me if I'm wrong. Go ahead.
No, I was actually going to start off with the exact same sentence. It says Emmy, correct me if I'm wrong. But I believe that working together with your team to go through these documents is always a good idea. I do not believe a health and safety plan is required for EPA to approve. That's my understanding. Emmy?
Yes, the site should have a health and safety plan. EPA doesn't need to play an approval role for that document. However, EPA might have its own health and safety plan that it will require its RPMs to adhere to when conducting oversight activities at that federal facility site.
Okay, and then also, so do the Department of Defense and Department of Energy, do they also have annual QAP review responsibilities?
I think the annual review,
RPM.
Go for it, Mary.
I believe that the annual review is agreed to as part of that UFP QAP process. So if you're a federal facility EPA RPM, you would be working with your DOD or DOE or counterpart, possibly the states, to go through and make sure that everything's still up to speed. But it's also always a good idea. There are always changes in maybe a technology or a methodology that's being used. We could use maybe an example right now, certain contaminants that are out there where something's changing every day. So it's always good to stay on top of what you have outlined in those documents.
Okay, and then very quickly, does the EPA review the SAPs for non-NPL sites as well?
No, this is, if you're working on a site with a team, again, not a bad idea to be working together on these documents, but at non-NPL sites, we do not have the federal facility agreement that requires it. So what we're talking about in this particular course really is focusing on the NPL sites.
Okay, fabulous. Thank you. I think in the interest of time, it's 1:30 right now. Let's go ahead and move on, and I think we're heading over to Emmy, correct?
Yes. Yes, we'll go ahead and pick it up on slide 14. That's the removal actual guidance, and non-time critical removal actions that we're going to focus more closely on. And remember, in this space, you have at least 6 months of planning time to implement that removal action. That's our non-time critical response space. So we want to take a look at some guidance specific to these types of removal actions, because once you have that federal facility site listed on the NPL, the whole plan is that we be able to move forward with cleanup promptly, and we can use removal actions, interim remedial actions, and of course a final remedial action to get to those goals of cleanup for the site. But we want to get, you know, move forward as quickly as we can, especially if there's some kind of imminent danger present to address that, and sometimes getting to a final action, that's just going to take longer, so we look for these opportunities to move forward more quickly with cleanup. But just because we're moving forward quickly doesn't mean that we should, you know, be careless about it. You want to make sure that you're progressing forward in a way that is consistent with the overall cleanup goals for the site, and it just ensures that all the agencies, the lead agency, the regulatory agencies, and the public are on the same page as far as where the cleanup is going. Because ultimately, you want to make sure that we have decisions that are consistent with the final cleanup decision that will be issued for that site. So in some of the guidance that we have for non-time critical removal actions, we look at how best to evaluate these type of actions. So strong consideration should be given to those non-time critical removal actions that will achieve results comparable to a remedial action, because you do have that minimum 6 months of planning time, right? But ideally, it would be completed faster than what a remedial action may take. As mentioned before, in selecting a non-time critical removal action, an ECA, that an engineering evaluation and cost analysis, needs to be done. And there's three criteria that are going to be looked at for these type of evaluations for the different alternatives. So you're looking at effectiveness. That essentially speaks to the protectiveness of that alternative. You're looking at implementability. How easy is it to actually take that action? And then cost is another criteria that's looked at when evaluating the different alternatives under a non-time critical removal action. So you're able to weigh the trade-offs between those different alternatives, put out that ECA for public comment, again, a minimum 30-day public comment period, before selecting the action that you're going to move forward with. And ideally, public comment could help influence the decision that's made. So what's the role of regulatory agencies if you have a lead agency under Executive Order 12580 implementing a removal action under its authority? Well, where does that leave the regulatory agencies? So keep in mind that EPA and the state should have adequate participation in the development of that proposed removal action. It's better that we work as a team and that we're all on the same page, essentially, when moving forward with those removal actions. If EPA and the state are involved early throughout the conversation and the decision-making process, it's going to help ensure that all parties are in agreement that this does, in fact, help the overall remediation plan for the site, from the selection of that removal action to monitoring its progress. And it gives the opportunity for the regulatory agencies to speak up sooner rather than later if there's some sort of disagreement or misunderstanding as to where that cleanup is going. You would rather have that conversation before time and resources are spent on implementing an action versus after the fact. So again, working as a team, including on removal actions, is really important for your site's cleanup. Another item I want to touch on quickly, this is related to ARARs and non-time critical removal actions. So ARARs are the applicable and relevant and appropriate requirements for a cleanup decision. And in a removal decision, you still want to make space to consider ARARs to the extent practicable. So there's that word, right? The extent practicable. What does that actually mean? Well, when you're looking whether or not something is practicable, like, is it feasible to meet it? Is it something that can be implemented successfully and reasonably? So with your removal actions, when you're looking at ARARs and seeing which may apply to the action that's being taken, you want to make sure, first off, that your removal action is in step with the long-term remediation goals for the site. So if it's not in step, or if it would preclude some kind of future remedial action, likely you're going to have a problem because that's not going to help the overall plan for the site. And generally, most removal actions, you should find it practicable to meet ARARs. If for some reason it's an issue or there's a site-specific circumstance where it's just not practicable, it's not feasible, it just, for whatever reason, can't be done under that removal action, keep in mind that you can defer meeting ARARs to the final remedial action if needed. So there's that option. But again, you don't want to take a removal action that's going to preclude future remedial action. So how do you know if it's going to preclude future remedial action? That's when you need to work with all parties at the site to make sure your regulatory agencies and your cleanup agencies are on the same page. Hopefully that's helped address that question of what is the extent practicable as far as ARARs go. So continuing on to our next slide, we're going to just touch base quickly on a joint memo that was issued between EPA and DOE in 1995. This is the policy on decommissioning DOE facilities under CERCLA. And this was related to the 1994 guidance, which I'm sorry, I forgot to mention, the last couple of slides on evaluating non-time critical removal actions was based on EPA's 1994 guidance that was on accelerating CERCLA environmental remediation at federal facilities. So that 1994 guidance came out, and then this memo was related to that, and it established the approach agreed upon by EPA and DOE for decommissioning surplus DOE facilities as a non-time critical removal action. So that showed in writing that there was agreement between these agencies, that this approach was consistent with CERCLA, that it helped to achieve risk reduction in a more timely fashion, and that non-time critical removal actions were the way to do this at these sites. It highlights EPA's oversight responsibility, DOE's responsibilities as the lead agency, and then stakeholder participation in that process. So this was all helping to gear quicker cleanups, more timely cleanups at federal facility sites. And this was just one way that the agencies worked together to try and find those paths forward to be able to do that, just get cleanup done more quickly. Because as you know, at federal facility sites, we tend to have very long time frames and very complex cleanups to address. So that is removal actions in a nutshell, quite quick. But I want to pause and see if there were any questions related to removal actions before we move into the records of decision section.
Emmy, I don't see any in the queue yet, so I think we should move on, but we can always circle back again in a few moments for another break if something does come in.
Okay, sounds good. So let's get into ROD. A lot of resources and time and pain even can go into getting a record of decision issued for a site. And I joke, but I also speak from personal experience that it is quite a process. So what is the purpose of a ROD? What's the point? Well, there's four main things that a ROD is supposed to do. The first is that it certifies the remedy selection process was carried out in accordance with CERCLA and the NCP. It also summarizes the technical rationale and background information that went into selecting that remedy. Thirdly, it provides technical information which outlines your remedial action objectives and your cleanup levels, which really are the drivers behind the cleanup that's being selected. And one item that's, I think, overlooked quite a bit is the purpose of a ROD as a key communication tool with the public. This is telling the public what the remedy is and why it was selected. That's why the responsiveness summary section of your ROD is so important. And we'll talk more about the sections of what should be in your ROD in a second. But one thing I want to point you all to is EPA's 1999 guidance on preparing proposed plans, RODs, and other remedy selection documents. This guidance, I think, as anyone who's involved in federal facility cleanups and you're involved with writing proposed plans and records of decisions, this guidance is going to be so helpful. I recommend downloading it to your computer. If you like hard copies to highlight and dog-ear, do that, because it is one of the most used pieces of guidance, I think, you'll use in federal facility cleanup if you're actively pursuing cleanup decisions at your site. So definitely mark that. I think we have links in the participant manual as well as the reference page for you to get your own copy, which I highly recommend doing. Okay, so back to the purpose of a ROD. We talked about these four things a ROD is supposed to do, the biggest being selecting a cleanup alternative, right? What is the remedial alternative we're selecting? So how do we select a cleanup alternative? What criteria are used? So I wanted to take a second to talk about the 9 criteria used to evaluate remedial alternatives. Sometimes you'll hear this referred to as the 9 CERCLA criteria. Well, these criteria are actually laid out in the NCP, but you know what they're talking about when you hear the reference to the 9 criteria. And they're put into 3 categories. The first category is threshold criteria. These are non-optional. A remedy has to be protective of human health and the environment, number 1. And number 2, it needs to comply with ARARs. And complying with ARARs might also mean getting an ARAR waived, which we'll touch on in a couple of the later slides. But those are your threshold criteria, non-optional. Then you have your primary balancing criteria, and these are used to weigh the trade-offs amongst the different remedial alternatives that are being considered in your RIFS development through your proposed plan. Of those 5 criteria, you have long-term effectiveness, which is basically looking at how permanent the remedy is, how effective is it going to be long-term. We have the reduction of TMV, toxicity, mobility, and volume. This really gets back to EPA's preference for treatment in remedial alternatives. You want to reduce these items, the toxicity, mobility, and volume of the waste that you're dealing with. Short-term effectiveness, which looks at what are the risks in implementation, risk to the public, risk to the site workers, risk to the environment as well in the short term, and implementability. And that gets back to how technically feasible is that alternative? How reliable is the technology that's being considered? Is it tried and true? Is it innovative and brand new and untested? That's going to help rate your implementability for a alternative. And lastly, cost. In the last category, we have modifying criteria. One thing I want you all to keep in mind, modifying criteria are not, let me think about this later. They actually are of equal importance as the primary balancing criteria, but they can't be fully considered until that proposed plan goes out for public comment. I think sometimes people maybe place less importance on the state acceptance and community acceptance of a remedial alternative, but they play equal roles. So definitely important to keep that in mind. So those are the criteria that are used to evaluate the different remedial alternatives. And once you weigh all of those, then you're able to go forward with selecting a remedial alternative in a ROD. So let's look more closely at what's in a record of decision. So you have 3 parts. Part 1 is a declaration. Think about this as an abstract to the ROD. It's going to have basic site information, a quick description of the selected remedy, and the signatures signing off on that remedy selection. In part 2, the decision summary, that's where the meat, I would say, of the document is. You have all, the technical information associated with the site, how that led to the different site characteristics that were considered, getting to your remedial action objectives, evaluating the different alternatives that were considered, and ultimately getting to your selected remedy. All of that's going to go in the decision summary. In part 3, that's where you have your responsiveness summary. So any public comments that were received on your proposed plan will merit a response. There are significant public comments that are received. You're going to provide a response to those in the responsiveness summary, and also identify any ways in which those comments helps change the remedy that was ultimately selected, particularly if it's different from the preferred alternative that was identified in the proposed plan. So that's the role that the responsiveness summary will play, and those are the 3 parts of a record of decision. So again, all this information is coming from that 1999 EPA guidance, or the ROD guidance for short, so definitely check it out if you haven't read that one yet. So before I jump into interim actions, I'll check with Jean. Are we okay to move forward, Jean?
We actually had a few questions that came in. Okay. And let me just start with this one about removal actions. Can they address groundwater cleanup?
A removal action could address groundwater cleanup. It likely isn't going to be the only action required, though. Mary, do you have other thoughts on groundwater and removal
action? No, I agree with that 100%. I don't think that we're currently using removal actions at a number of sites to address ingestion. And that removal is actually being done as sort of an interim action. It's being done as the first part of what will eventually be a larger remedial action.
Okay. Our next question just gets into the 1995 policy and what it specifically may exclude. Since it specifically identifies decommissioning activities, does that mean that it excludes deactivation activities?
So that memo goes into a lot of details, and I'll say there's a lot of D's in it. Decommissioning, dismantling, demolition, all of those items are touched on in the memo with more detail, but you'll hear that referred to as the D&D memo for short. So I would definitely say if you have specific questions, take a look at the language, because more than just decommissioning, which really is a big category that covers a lot of different activities, is discussed.
Okay, and we had, we'll take one more question here. Someone commented that since the federal agency is a lead agent and a funding source, can you confirm if EPA is not reviewing or signing the action memos?
So if a lead cleanup agency is conducting a removal under its removal authority, EPA typically is not going to sign off on that removal action because the authority is actually designated to the lead cleanup agency. However, your regulatory agencies will review that document to ensure, again, that it is consistent with the overall cleanup plan for the site and that it won't preclude any future remedial actions envisioned for the site. So it's not that EPA signs off. I will say, though, look at your federal facility agreements because your FFA, it's unique to just a few sites out there, might actually have language that gives EPA or the state some kind of approval process. So I'm not sure what site this person's experience is at, but it might be something specific to your FFA, not necessarily CERCLA, that's driving that approval.
Okay, great. I do have a few other questions in the queue, but I think just in the interest of time, let's move on and then we can come back to them later on.
Okay, sounds good. So we're continuing with interim actions. We spent quite a lot of time talking about ROD as a final action, but sometimes an interim action might be appropriate. So this could be determined during the scoping or other points of the RIFS, that's the Remedial Investigation and Feasibility Study process, that the lead agency may determine an interim action really makes a lot of sense here. Interim actions are limited in scope, so they'll be addressing specific areas or specific media, understanding that a final remedial action will be needed for the site. So some reasons for taking an interim action may include the need to take quick actions to protect human health and the environment, or the need to institute some kind of temporary measure that will stabilize the site or prevent further migration of contaminants, you know, first to make sure that exposures aren't happening and to help stop any further environmental degradation. So those are some of the reasons you might decide an interim action makes sense for your site. Again, check your FFAs. Usually the lead agency will help decide if an interim action is needed, but some FFAs will specify that EPA or the state might be able to make that determination as well. Overall, to me, it's a site team effort. It's a project team effort, and you should be having these discussions as to whether a final or remedial action makes sense for the issue that, or the risk that you're trying to address. So what's the role of interim actions? Why interim versus final? Well, again, an interim action can be a step in getting to that final cleanup goal for a site. And it might be that you implement an interim action, and when you get to a final ROD stage, no further action is warranted because you've addressed all the risks. Or it might be that your final decision will identify additional work that needs to be done. It depends on what you're dealing with at your site. Keep in mind an interim action has to be followed up by a final ROD. Regardless, though, your interim action should still be protective of human health and the environment. That is non-optional. We can't be choosing alternatives that are not protective under CERCLA. And when it comes to your ARARS discussion in that interim decision, you're focusing only on the media and the scope that's actually in the interim decision. The final remedy will look at the larger list of ARARs that apply, but for interim actions, it's specific to the scope of that interim action that's being done. So what are some examples of interim actions? Well, you could install some extraction wells to address contaminated groundwater with the intention of remediating the entire aquifer in the future. Or you might be providing temporary alternative source of drinking water to a community with the intention of doing something about the contamination in the aquifer at a later time. But you want to address that imminent risk soon, quickly, promptly, hence providing alternative drinking water source. Or it could be something like constructing a temporary cap to control or reduce exposures until a subsequent action can be taken to determine how to address the risk from that waste. These are all examples taken from that 1999 ROD guidance. So if you want more examples, that would be a great place to look. What are the pros and cons then between doing an interim action versus the final action? Okay, well, some pros, you can tailor the scope to be limited specifically to what you're trying to address. It can help you more quickly institute temporary measures to address exposures at a site and help prevent further migration. Under an interim action, you don't have to meet all the ARARs that would apply under a final ROD. Again, keeping in mind that your remedy still needs to be protective. You can't take that too far. And it also allows the opportunity to gather more data. That's going to help refine your conceptual site model, and it will help you better select a final remedy for the site because you'll be understanding your site much better with whatever data is collected during implementation of the interim remedy. What are some cons? Well, you still have to follow up that interim decision with a final ROD, and some groups can view that as an ineffective use of resources. It can take a similar amount of time and effort to issue an interim ROD as a final ROD. That's something to keep in mind. And some agencies, just as a policy, prefer final RODs over interim RODs. So that's important to be aware of with your site teams. And an interim ROD can limit property transfer because you don't have a final remedy constructed and operating on site. You're not going to be able, as the lead agency, to transfer that land as easily. So as far as touching more on the views on interim actions, like I mentioned, different agencies view the role of interim actions differently. EPA supports the use of interim RODs. However, DOE has also expressed a support for the use of interim RODs, and that's seen by their use across the DOE complex. If you're working on a DOD site, though, in your site team discussions, you might see that DOE has expressed less support for the use of interim RODs and would rather focus on getting to those final decisions, getting those in place, instead of going through the interim ROD, final ROD process. So I'm not saying any of these are good or bad, but it's important to know the different stances people in the room have when you're having these conversations so you can find the best path forward that works for all of the parties involved in cleanup at your site. So I talked a little bit about the interim action waiver, and this is one of six waivers identified in the NCP. Because remember I mentioned that threshold criteria, you have to have remedies that are protective of human health and the environment, and you either have to comply with ARARs or get a waiver for them. So an interim action ARAR waiver is listed, the first one listed in the NCP for these types of waivers, and it can be used when you're using an interim remedy knowing that a final decision is coming for those OUs or for that site. That interim decision is not designed to be final, it's not expected to be final, but you're still looking for the best trade-off amongst the different alternatives that are presented using, again, those 9 criteria from the NCP. And even though the preference for treatment should really be addressed in the final ROD, interim decisions, it's going to be more favorable if that also has a preference for treatment or support of that preference in your interim decision. Oops. So I want to, I went a little crazy with the slides there. The next thing I want to do is give you a real life example of how an interim decision can be used, because we're talking, providing a lot of information to you all, and it kind of helps to see, well, how did this actually play out in the real world? So, and this is a groundwater example, so that might be helpful. This is taken from the Hanford site, which is located in South Central Washington. You can see right here on the figure where it's highlighted. And the Hanford site is where we made all our plutonium during the Cold War. So about 45 years of plutonium production led to soil and groundwater contamination across the site. We're focusing on the central portion of the site where a lot of chemical processing activities happen. And because of liquid waste disposal, as you can see in this very colorful picture on your screen, we have a number of groundwater plumes that are in this part of the site because they were released to the ground during production years. So we're focusing on the UP1 groundwater OU that's identified here in the bottom half of the square that we're looking at. So you can see we have a number of very large plumes. These range from about 200 to 250 feet below ground surface. We have tritium, iodine-129, carbon tetrachloride, chromium, like a whole lot going on here. But what I want to draw your attention to is this part of the plumes where we have uranium and technetium present. So we'll go to the next slide and talk about the interim remedy that was selected. This was selected back in 1997, and the interim action was intended to stabilize and reduce contaminant mass in the high concentration area of the plume through pump and treat, essentially, groundwater extraction and treatment. The high concentration zone was considered any area of that plume that was 10 times the cleanup levels for uranium and technetium-99. So notice we're not quoting MCLs under the Safe Drinking Water Act here. We were actually looking at parts of the plume that were 10 times that cleanup level. So we're not achieving MCLs, even though the goal eventually is to restore this aquifer as a potential future drinking water source. But by focusing just on that very hot zone, we were reducing the contaminant mass, which was going to help support the long-term remediation plans to restore that aquifer. And under the interim action, which ended in 2011, you can see how much contamination was removed. Although this interim action was focusing on uranium and technetium, we also were able to remove a significant amount of carbon tetrachloride and nitrate because they were co-located with the contaminants that we were focused on. So this is just one example of how that interim action, which didn't meet all the ARARs that a final remedy would need to meet, was able to be used to support a preference for treatment, all in getting to the final goals for restoration of groundwater at this particular site. So hopefully that helps illustrate to you how an interim action can be used. We're going to just touch on one last item related to interim actions, and that's the completion of interim actions. At headquarters, we've gotten a lot more questions about the use of this 2006 DOD EPA joint guidance that was issued and the 2011 EPA guidance on how to close out a site. So in 2006, DOD and EPA had issued joint guidance about site closeout and MPL deletions, where we would rely on an IRACR, an Interim Remedial Action Report, to document that an RA had been completed for groundwater or surface water. And we used that process from 2006. But then in 2011, EPA issued its own guidance on closeout procedures for national priority list sites. And that eliminated the distinction between interim remedial action reports and final remedial action reports. So EPA is not using IRACRs in the way that they were used before. And there are some DOD sites that are still relying on the use of an IRACR to identify that cleanup goals have been met. So there's quite a bit of confusion about this in our site. So we want to make sure that resources aren't being spent on documents that aren't necessarily required for EPA anymore, but that we're still documenting success and progress at our sites accordingly. So no more IRACRs are needed. And if you get to the point where you have achieved your remedial action objectives and cleanup levels for a site, then all that data should go into a final closeout report instead of an RA report. So here's a graphic to illustrate this point a little bit more. This is taken right out of our EPA guidance. I've lost the name of this guidance, but my whole point here on the graphic, look at the bottom area. This is where we are specific to federal facilities. So you start your RA, your remedial action, and your go through construction of that document. And then you'll get to the point where you completed construction and you start to show that the remedy is operating and functioning as intended. So once you get to that point, that's where you get into the long-term O&M for a site, especially at federal facilities. At that transition point, that's when your RA report should be issued. And then once you're done with O&M and you've actually achieved your cleanup levels and remedial action objectives, then you'll do your site closeout report. So hopefully that's helped address some questions on the documentation needed. If you have an interim action and it's going to be decades before your final action and you want to have a document to highlight the progress made, talk with your site team about what that should look like. You can add those documents to the administrative record to ensure when you're ready to close out the site that you have all the documentation you need. All right, moving on, we'll get to our next topic on changing the remedy post-rod. And Mary, are you up?
I am. Jean, before we move forward, do we have any questions on the interim action section?
We do. We have a number of questions that have come in. And so I'm going to start with this first one, asking if the DOD by itself, do they support interim rods?
I won't speak for DOD, but in the last couple of years, there has been a tendency to steer away from the interim rods for a number of reasons, but that is really a decision that was made by them. If you are working on a team and you have that your DOD person, you can ask them. I do know there's some sites, depending on what the issues are, it may be something that's considered. But for the most part, I've seen that it's been they've been sort of not going that route.
Okay. What about interim actions if there is not an imminent threat of release or no potential degradation of environmental conditions in the near term? They just want to know if the interim action will ultimately wind up being the final remedial action.
So in that case, I would say kind of. So you might have an interim action when implemented meet the overall cleanup objectives for the site, but you still need to follow up with a final remedy. That final remedy may very well be a no further action rod, where you identify that you've met the cleanup objectives for the site and no further action is needed. That's fairly straightforward, usually a lot easier to write than when you're selecting a remedial alternative, but you still need that final rod, even if it's a no further action rod.
Okay. We did have a participant mention that the DOD, or specifically the Navy, uses iRACER, which is IRACR, to document remedy in place, and something called RACER, RACR, to document response completions. I don't know if you guys can comment on either one of those tools.
So I think the IRACR acronym is the same. If I understood, the statement is that the Navy uses the interim remedial action. Gosh, I'm getting my acronyms confused.
Remedial action completion report.
Thank you, Mary. A remedial action completion report. Again, that's appropriate when you've constructed your remedy and you're going into that long-term O&M. Could you repeat for me, Jean, if they're saying that they use a different approach or they use it in a different way?
Well, essentially all they were saying, and bear with me while I get these ones back up here on the screen, they were merely commenting, and they don't have a question mark here. They just say that Navy uses IRACR to document remedy in place and RACR to document response complete.
Okay.
Right. That's not inconsistent with what the 2006 guidance was. And some of the sites that have been being worked for any length of time may have operable units or remedies that still fall under that old system. The question I think for both EPA and DOD or anyone else is how do we marry the new guidance to how we did business then and be able to collect that information into the new databases.
Okay. I'm going to take a question here, but I'm just going to also comment generally to a number of the very site-specific or participant-specific questions who have come in. A number of people have kind of written very detailed narratives about their particulars and wanting to know if they could chat with you offline. So I just wanted to check if people have very site-specific questions, can they follow up with you individually?
Sure. Absolutely. I think we're always willing to engage in a conversation. As far as headquarters answering site-specific questions for the region, we may want, we're always very careful to include our EPA regions in these types of discussions, but if there's a high-level question or at least the beginning of a conversation we can help with, we're definitely happy to do that.
Okay. All right, so let's take one more question here, and then we'll carry on. Would a proposed plan followed with a ROD for deferred actions be a good or better option in certain circumstances?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure what they mean by deferred action.
They had asked earlier for pros and cons of moving forward with an IROD for a partial proposed plan, and then had chimed in later on, would it be a better approach if they used their proposed plan followed with a ROD for deferred actions rather than the IROD?
I'll probably need to talk more with that person offline just to better understand their question. Ideally, you're issuing a ROD because you're taking action. So if you're deferring action or deferring to a different program or something like that, then that's a different conversation. But I'd be happy to follow up with them.
Okay. All right. I think here at 2:07, we'll go ahead and carry on with the presentation. And Mary, I think you're up, but we will break again soon for Q&A.
Great. Well, thanks, Jean. So we're going to talk a little bit about changing the remedy post-ROD. The lead agency's categorization of a post-ROD change to the selected remedy is a site-specific determination and must consider the following. First is scope. Does it change, alter the scope of the remedy? For an example, the type of treatment or containment technology, physical area of the response, remediation goals to be achieved, type and volume of waste to be addressed. The performance, would the change alter the performance of the remedy, the treatment levels to be attained, the long-term reliability of the remedy, and we're also going to be looking at cost. Are there significant changes in cost from the estimates in the ROD, taking into account some uncertainties associated with engineering? When we're doing the feasibility study, we're expected to have an accuracy of about plus 50%, minus 30%. But when we're looking at a post-ROD change, we're looking at scope, performance, and cost of the proposed change. There we go. So based on this evaluation, and depending on the extent of the scope or the modification being considered, the lead agency must make a determination as to the type of change involved. Is it non-significant or minor, significant, or is it a fundamental change? Remedy changes should fall along the continuum from minor to fundamental. Similarly, an aggregate of non-significant, significant changes could result in a fundamental change. The type of documentation required for a post-ROD change depends on the nature of the change. Changes that significantly or fundamentally affect the remedy selected in the ROD will require more explanation and opportunity for public comment than those that don't. Each type of post-ROD change is associated with one of three documentation procedures. The first is a memo or a note to a post-ROD file for an insignificant or minor change, an explanation of significant differences or the ESD for a significant change, and for a fundamental change, we would be doing a ROD amendment or the Record of Decision amendment. For the non-significant minor change, these usually arise during a design, or construction. They won't have a significant impact on scope, performance, or cost of the remedy. And any non-significant or minor changes should be recorded in a post-ROD site file, maybe the RDRA case file. If the lead agency chooses, non-significant changes can also be documented for the public in an RD fact sheet or remedial design fact sheet. Although not legally required, a written statement describing the change is generally recommended. Significant changes generally involve a change to a component of a remedy that's not that does not fundamentally alter the overall cleanup approach. And the fundamental change, the fundamental changes involve an appreciable change or changes in the scope, performance, and or cost, or may number, you may have a number of significant changes that together, as I mentioned earlier, have the effect of being a fundamental change. An example of a fundamental change is one that results in the reconsideration of an overall waste management approach selected in the original ROD. One way of looking at significant versus fundamental is, could the change have been reasonably anticipated? For example, if you have a promulgated AWAR, that may impact the volume, cost, or cleanup level of a select remedy, but it won't change the remedy or impact the protection of the remedy. That would be a significant change. If the primary treatment selected in the ROD were to change because of that change in a promulgated AWAR, that would be fundamental. So we're going to do a little exercise here, and I think Jean's going to help me out. Based on the type of change, hi, Jean. Based on the type of change, what document would you use? So if you look at the little boxes below,
Mary, we're going to go ahead and just remind the audience that they now have some new question boxes on the bottom half of their screen. So each one of the boxes is labeled either A, B, or C, corresponding to significant changes, fundamental changes, or minor changes. Underneath each one of those options, they can select the type of document that would be based off of that type of a change. So it's either going to be a memo to file, explanation of significant differences, or ROD. So you simply need to look under each box and then click the circle next to the type of document that you think would correspond to that type of change. So we'll give you all just a few more seconds here to cast your votes, and then we will talk a little bit about what we're seeing. And so as I'm starting to see some shifts, Mary, it looks like they are honing in together on the same answer, but there are some variations across all of the respondents. So I think we've given them enough time, so let's go ahead and end these polls, lock those votes in. And Mary, can we talk about the right answers?
I would come. The first one, if we have a significant change, what kind of document would we be using for that? And that's going to be an ESD. It's going to be your explanation of significant differences. For B, the fundamental change, you have something that's fundamentally changing your ROD here, you are going to have to do a ROD amendment. And for the last one, a minor change, a memo to file. And we'll be talking more about, other than the memo to file, we'll be talking more about these in the next couple of slides. Thanks, Jean. So let's start with the explanation of significant difference, and we'll go into a little bit more detail here. An ESD document, significant change. The change will have a significant impact on the scope, performance, or cost of the remedy. I'm sorry, I didn't move my slide. I thought it did, but there it goes. Okay. Significant changes generally involve a change to a component of the remedy that does not fundamentally alter the overall cleanup approach. I mentioned earlier, one way of looking at significant versus fundamental is, could it have reasonably be anticipated? An ESD must describe to the public the nature of the significant change, summarize the information that led to the making of the change or changes, and affirm that the revised remedy complies with the NCP and the statutory requirements of CERCLA. Generally, a new nine-criteria analysis is not required for an ESD. But the ESD must continue to be protective and meet applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, or AWARs. A side-by-side comparison of the original and proposed remedy components are suggested to clearly display the significant differences. You're comparing in our example picture here, you're comparing a Honeycrisp to a Golden Delicious apple. The change is significant, but the remedy is not fundamentally changed. Keep in mind that while it's not required, the site team can choose to conduct community involvement activities such as issuing a fact sheet, hosting a meeting or an open house or a webinar. Additional activities should be considered where there's considerable public interest. While the public outreach isn't mandatory, notification still is. The lead agency must publish a notice of availability and a brief description of the ESD in a major local newspaper of general circulation. The document must be made available to the public by placing it into the administrative record file and information repository. So a couple of examples of where we would use an ESD or what would be an ESD example. When there's a large increase in volume cost, sampling during the remedial design phase indicated the need to significantly increase the volume of contaminated waste material, substantially increasing the cost of the remedy. Another example is when secondary technology is introduced to enhance a remedy. A lead agency decides to use a biological treatment method instead of air stripping, which was specified in the ROD, for an ex situ treatment of extracted groundwater. The basic pump and treat approach remains unaltered, and the cleanup levels in the ROD will be met by an alternate technology. The change is significant, but not fundamental. The primary treatment, the pump and treat, remains the same. It's the secondary treatment that's being altered, that's being modified to meet the same outcome. So the next change we're going to talk about are ROD amendments. And it's a little different here. We're now comparing apples to oranges. The ROD amendment is used to document a fundamental change to the remedy selected in the ROD. You may sometimes hear of this referred to as opening the ROD or opening the AORs. Fundamental changes involve an appreciable change or changes to the scope, performance, and or cost. And there may be an instance where a number of significant changes together have resulted in having the effect of a fundamental change. And we may want to document that as well in a ROD amendment. An example of a fundamental change is one that results in a reconsideration of the overall management approach, just like I mentioned earlier, selected in the original ROD. Now, this scenario calls for the issuance of a revised proposed plan that highlights the proposed changes and an amended ROD. Just like in the ESD, a side-by-side comparison of the original and proposed remedy components is suggested to clearly display the differences, and the focus of the amendment should be to document the rationale for the amendment and provide assurances that the proposed remedy satisfies the statutory requirements. Unlike the ESD process, the ROD amendment calls for a new design criteria analysis, which Emmy went over earlier, including the AVAR analysis for the portion of the ROD that's now being amended. So while we're working on the ROD amendment, RDRA activity is being conducted on other portions of the site or at operable units not proposed for changes may continue during the amendment process. When fundamental changes are proposed to the ROD, the lead agency must conduct the public participation and documentation procedures specified in the NCP, which include the public comment period on the proposed plan. And as with the original proposed plan or the ROD process, the public must be afforded the opportunity to provide comments on the changes to the remedy that were not considered in the original ROD, given the changes proposed are fundamentally different from the original remedy. And you've heard me mention this before, the public could not have reasonably anticipated seeing this drastic a change, a fundamental change to the ROD, and therefore must be given the opportunity to opine on this decision. So now we have ROD amendment examples. Again, first one, a change in the primary treatment method. The in-situ soil washing selected in the ROD proves to be infeasible to implement after testing during remedial design. A decision is made to fundamentally change the remedy to excavate and thermally treat the waste. In the second example, remedy change from contaminant containment to treatment with cost increase. During a five-year review for a small industrial site, tests indicate that the containment remedy will not be protective, and now a more active response approach treatment is necessary. A new remedy must be selected that will meet protectiveness requirements, resulting in unanticipated costs for the site. So we're going to apply our understanding. And time for another quiz. So Jean, can you pull this up again?
Absolutely. So we're going to go ahead and change the screen here. And again, a new window is going to pop up on the bottom portion of your screen. So let's take a look at this question, where we're now asking which one of these is a fundamental change to the rod and requires a rod amendment. So in this case, you simply need to click on the circle to the left of the answer that you think is correct. Is it A, a new technology enhancing the selected remedy was brought to the lead agency and now they want to use it? Is it B, the selected remedy is not removing a contaminant efficiently enough and that lead agency has now decided to pursue an alternative remedy? Or is it C, the cleanup level noted in the rod is no longer protective enough and needs to be changed? So I see votes are coming in, and there is a bit of a distribution in responses, but we'll give you here just a few more seconds. And let's go ahead.
While we're waiting for these votes to come in, I would like to let folks know that this, a lot of what we're talking about here comes directly from the Guide to Preparing Superfund Proposed Plans, Records of Decisions, and Other Remedy Decision Documents. And that is, that I believe is listed in your references as well, and I believe it's also in your notes, the notes portions of these slides.
All right, so let's go ahead and lock in those answers and take a look. So Mary, I see a variation. It looks like two-thirds of the audience thought it was option B, and roughly a third thought it was C, and then a handful of people thought it was A. What's the right answer?
Awesome. Well, the answer is B. This is going to be a fundamental change. This will require a rod amendment because, thank you. Thank you for using the printer. The selected remedy is not removing a contaminant efficiently enough, and the lead agency has decided to pursue an alternative remedy. So this will require a rod amendment because the remedy selected was not sufficiently protective nor effective, and the primary treatment method that we had had in the rod will need to be changed or amended. Now, A would be significant, but not fundamental. This would require an ESD because the original remedy is still being utilized. You have your new technology enhancing the selected remedy being brought to the lead agency. They want to use that now. We talked about a similar situation back on slide 42 with the utilization of that secondary treatment to achieve the same goals without modifying the selected remedy. And for C, the cleanup level noted in the rod is no longer protective enough and needs to be changed. This would also be significant but not fundamental. This would require an ESD because the cleanup level would need to be changed. But this doesn't fundamentally change a selected remedy necessarily. As I mentioned earlier, a change in the promulgated AROR may impact the volume, cost, or cleanup of a selected remedy, but it won't necessarily change the remedy or impact the protection of the remedy. So this is a significant change. If the primary treatment selected in the rod were to change, now that would be a fundamental change and require a rod amendment.
A little tricky on that last one, but I think you explained it well, Mary.
Thank you.
Great. All right. So we're going to go ahead and jump into adaptive management, unless there were any specific questions we need to address first. Jean, do we have any come in?
Yeah, there were a few questions, and one of these was asking about the addition of land use controls. Do you consider that and a change in compliance levels as significant or fundamental changes?
So the question about, is it that additional institutional controls were being added?
Yeah.
Or
so they
weren't envisioned in the original ROD?
Yeah, so would you consider the addition of land use controls and a change in compliance levels as significant or a fundamental change?
Do you have thoughts on that, Mary?
I don't know if I felt so. my gut reaction is depending on the land use controls you're using. Some, I think, would, it really depends on the land use or if we're moving as far as engineering controls, how extreme they are. I think if you're just adding something relatively minor, you already have a pump and treat, you already know that nobody's drinking the groundwater, and you want to add another level of protection there, I don't know that that would rise to the level of fundamental. But there probably are examples out there where you would have a combination of LUX added to a possible document that combination, that marriage, like we talked about, may actually rise to the level of a fundamental change. I think it's really site-specific.
Yeah, we've had a few people comment that sometimes the institutional controls can be major components of a remedy. So if you were adding them in or changing them, that would be a remedy change, or at least from their perspectives or in their experience, that's what they've seen. Okay. We did have a question if an addition of a new treatment technology to an existing pump and treat system, which was added in because they wanted to treat a new contaminant, would that be considered significant or fundamental?
There's a lot of levels to that question. So if you're treating a new contaminant, does that mean that you've added a COC to a contaminant of concern to your record of decision? And did the remedial alternatives considered actually consider the nature and extent of that contaminant? So that, I think, is a bigger issue. If it is a co-located contaminant that's being perhaps extracted through pump and treat and you want to ensure that your facility can address that chemical or contaminant as it passes through, there's a lot of questions there because you have to first understand the risk posed by that chemical, and you definitely want to make sure you're not reinjecting into an aquifer at levels that would pose a risk otherwise. So I hate to say it's not a clear-cut answer. Mary, do you have other thoughts?
No, I think you really hit it. If you're adding a component and your remedy is the pump and treat, your remedy is not being changed, but you're adding to see if adding another component will enhance the remedy, that idea, that concept in and of itself would probably fall under significant change. But it depends on is it impacting remedy? Are we changing the fundamentals of this document? Are we changing the fundamentals of the rod by adding this as part of that treatment train? Is it going to impact the protectiveness? And so I think there's a lot of questions that we could unpack with this one.
Okay, let's just take one more question then, and that's about defining enhancements of existing remedies. Specifically, when you're defining the enhancements of an existing remedy to speed up the site closure, they wanted to know, for example, if you're enhancing MNA by applying some sort of source zone bioremediation, would that be included in the definition?
Well, if your selected remedy was for monitored natural attenuation, assuming that those were all natural processes, and then you want to enhance that with some kind of in situ treatment, are you still doing MNA, or are you doing MNA and this other technology? I think that is an interesting question. Mary, I'm going to turn to you and see if you have thoughts on adding an in situ treatment to an MNA remedy.
I think the MNA is a tough one because, like you said, your whole remedy is monitored natural attenuation, and you would then be enhancing it with a non-natural process. One of the issues here is I think you'd also there would be that possibility of opening up the document because you'd want to show that whatever you're doing is not impacting all the data that you've collected to show that MNA works here. Are you going to be impacting that? So that MNA is an interesting one. On the surface, it sounds like it would be significant, but because of it being MNA and any possible any possible interactions with the, your chemical, let's say it's an in situ process, would have on that. You might end up in the wonderful world of fundamental. The one thing to keep in mind with these also is, while significant doesn't require the public comment, the public participation that fundamental does, when you're talking something that is that's really on that line, you know, EPA tends to say better err on the side of caution. And if you're on that line, it just may be more publicly acceptable, because you still are going to have that public input, to just take that extra step and go with a fundamental change, and do a ROD amendment, to get that public input, so that the public is aware of what's going on and up to speed as you guys are moving forward.
Okay. All right. I do see that there are still a few other questions in the queue. But I think we'll go ahead and move on. We should have some time at the end where we can come back. So I want to thank everybody for coming in with these really great technical questions, and keep it up. But why don't we carry on with the presentation?
Great. So we have two more topics left. The first is adaptive management, and then we're going to touch base on five-year reviews. So with adaptive management, let me just switch my slide here. EPA has renewed its focus on adaptive management. EPA issued a memo in July of 2018 that was really looking at the use of adaptive management at our Superfund sites. So I won't read this entire slide to you, but I just want to highlight the areas that are identified in yellow, showing that adaptive management is really about evaluating data and setting site priorities, because we have limited resources and limited time. So how can we, through a structured and continuous planning approach, try and reduce the uncertainties at our site so we can best use the resources that are available and get ultimately to site completion? So that is the essence of the memo that was issued. And that memo also had a figure in it, which is on your slides now. So this is adaptive management's application in the Superfund remedial process. And you'll notice we have a couple of repeating circles here. So when we talk about adaptive management, that's a big word, and it can mean different things to different people. So in the 2018 memo, EPA tried to define what its approach to adaptive management was, and we've implemented a pilot study to look at different sites across our program to see how we can better implement adaptive management into the cleanup process. So it's a long process, right? We saw that figure earlier today in the slides, the convoluted map of all the different ways we travel from getting a site listed on the NPL to ultimately site closeout. So in these different sections of the CERCLA process, we've identified these opportunities for adaptive management. In your RIFS process, shown here, shown with the green arrow, that's our first circle here. So if you are in the RIFS process at your site early in that stage, you could potentially use adaptive management to help ensure that you are engaging your stakeholders, particularly if there's a high level of interest at that site. You can engage them in conversations about a high level overall site strategy for cleanup at that site. By working with groups to get earlier buy-in to what the overall plan is, hearing their concerns, making sure that's addressed through what you're considering at the site, that's one great way to take that information early and incorporate it into the decision-making process. Then we have, if you're, say, in RDRA space at your site, and in this do loop here, you're looking, we design a remedy, we build it, we assess its performance, and we go through this loop of our design process. Well, if you're, say, feeding into your design during your characterization, you could look at using adaptive management to help target your resources by using things like real-time measurements and technologies that allow your field teams to have to deploy less times to get that site data and ultimately feed into the remedial alternatives that will be considered for your site. In RDRA, you might be doing treatability studies that are, again, going to inform which alternatives you can focus on and consider moving through that RAFS process, all the while trying to reduce uncertainties in the remedy selection process. Finally, say you're past that. You have a ROD at your site. You're an O&M, and you've been an O&M for a while. I think there's a lot of federal facility sites that are living in that space because they issued that record of decision, and they're just trying to get to their cleanup goals and remedial action objectives. So say you have a remedy that's somewhat stuck. You could look at adaptive management in this O&M space to monitor, you know, what's going on. You're assessing it. Then you try and optimize. Optimization studies, particularly for groundwater remedies, is one great way to try and use your resources better at a site instead of just being in this stuck space where you're not seeing a ton of progress or return on the remedy that's being implemented. So through optimization, you might be able to find additional ways to further clean up at your site, all to get you to that goal of site completion. So again, EPA, through our Superfund task force efforts, have been focusing more on this. I believe the plan is to finish our pilot study at looking at different sites that have tried to incorporate this and ultimately issue additional guidance or information on how that is going. So we're going to have another apply your understanding or quiz time, as I like to call it, to see if you can envision where adaptive management would make sense for your site. So we have a couple of examples, and from this list of examples, we would like you to identify which would benefit from an adaptive management approach. So multiple choice, multiple answers. You can select more than one, and I'll let Jean take it over.
All right, so I'll remind everybody that there's that new box on the bottom half of your screen. You'll have four options where you can indicate which of these examples would benefit from adaptive management. There's option A, where we had pump and treats with a groundwater remedy that's been operating for 10 years and the contaminant levels are not decreasing as they were expected. Option B, where the site is in the RIFS phase and it's preparing for some sampling activities and there's a high level of uncertainty where the contamination is located. And then we also have option C, where multiple stakeholders have a high level of interest in that site that's scoping RIFS activities, and it's anticipated that the public will want to be heavily involved through this process. And then the fourth option, option D, is for an early action to remove barrels filled with hazardous substances that's needed at a site. So you simply need to check or click the boxes to the left of any or all of the answers that you think could benefit from an adaptive management approach. So you could check some, all, none. I'll give you just a moment or two more. It doesn't look like there seems to be a general consensus here. And we'll go ahead and lock down these responses and take a look at how the audience voted. So Emmy, it looks like 3/4 of them thought that option A was the right answer, about 2/3 picked B, and then just under a half picked C, with a handful of people picking option D. What is the right answer?
So if you voted for options A, B, and C, those are all situations that could possibly benefit from an adaptive management approach. I know some people also voted for D, that early action to remove barrels filled with a hazardous substance. I think if you start thinking too much about it, you could consider an adaptive management approach to try and assess what's in the barrels and how quickly it needs to be removed and what to do with them. But for this example, what we were really trying to highlight was that with that early action, the certainty is pretty high. These barrels have to go. And once they're gone, then you can determine if any additional risks remain. As far as the other examples in scenarios A, B, and C, really showing that adaptive management could be considered to help reduce uncertainties and ensure stakeholder participation in those situations. Hopefully you enjoyed the quiz. We try and make it so that you can apply your understanding and make sure you're following along with us on these slides. But if we're ready, and unless there's questions, Jean, we could go on to 5-year reviews.
No, I think let's go ahead and move on to the next segment.
Okay. So jumping into our last topic for this webinar, we're going to look at 5-year reviews and impact on remedies. So this is not a 5-year review training. We have Federal Facility 5-year review training being offered as part of the Federal Facilities Academy. So definitely look for that if you want a lot more information on 5-year reviews. But as far as how it's related back to remedies, just want to give everyone their bearings. Anytime there's waste left in place at a site that doesn't allow for unlimited use and unlimited exposure, or UUUE for short, essentially 5-year reviews need to be done every 5 years from the initiation of that remedial action. And consistent with Executive Order 12580, it's the lead agency's responsibility to ensure that the five-year reviews are conducted at their site where they're required or appropriate. So for federal facility sites, the lead agency is going to conduct the five-year review, prepare the report, and then submit that report to EPA for review and comment. Then EPA can either concur with the protectiveness determinations made by that lead agency, or EPA can choose to provide independent findings if there's a disagreement from what the lead agency has put forward in the five-year review. The lead agency is also responsible for ensuring that any recommendations and follow-up actions identified in the report are completed. So let's move on to what protective determinations are in five-year reviews. So there's generally five different categories. You can determine in your five-year review that the remedy is protective. Again, for federal facility sites, we often roll up review of remedies for a number of different operable units because our sites are so large and complex. So for each record of decision that you have where a remedy has been identified, you're going to determine if it is protective. And in doing that, there's these five categories listed on your slide. It can be protective, the good green light, things look good to go. Or you could identify that it will be protective once the remedy is completed. So this is more common for sites that are in construction, but there are controls in place to ensure that exposures are not happening during remedy implementation. So you have that will be protective once the remedy is complete. Then the next category is protective in the short term. So that's where you're saying, okay, it's protective for now, but in order for the remedy to be protective in the long term, there's a number of follow-up actions that have to be taken. So that's why it gets the yellow marker. Then big red X is if it's not protective and, you know, certain actions are required to ensure protectiveness. You generally do not want to have a remedy that's not protective. That's a big flashing light that something needs to happen. And we'll touch more on that in a second on the upcoming slide. You also have a protectiveness cannot be determined until further information is obtained, or protectiveness deferred for short. This has a yellow marker on it as well. If you're in this situation and more information is needed, ideally your five-year review will identify a time frame by which that information will be collected through whatever additional studies or analysis are needed to better understand whether or not the remedy is protective. So let's look at some examples where the remedy is not protective. So remedies are considered not protective if there's an imminent threat present. You know, there's some exposure pathway that's not being controlled where people could be exposed or there's exposure potential in the environment. It might be if there's a migration of contaminants that is not controlled, also posing unacceptable risk to human health and the environment. Potential or actual exposure is clearly present and there's evidence of exposure, meaning that could mean your ICs or institutional controls are not in place or they're not working, they're not being enforced, and there are exposures happening. Your remedy is not protective if there are exposures occurring. And lastly, the remedy cannot meet a new cleanup level, and the previous cleanup level is outside of the risk range. So this might happen when there's new information that comes to light. Remember, with our five-year review, there are three questions, essentially, that are being asked. Is the remedy functioning as intended? Is there changes in the assumptions, such as toxicity data and other information that's changed since the remedy was issued? And lastly, is there any other information that's come to light that can affect the protectiveness of the remedy? So if you have a new cleanup level or a new, you know, risk value that's become more conservative and your remedy wasn't designed to meet that, but you have this new information where we now understand, hey, this poses an unacceptable risk, that, again, is a big signal. Some action needs to be taken here because this is not protective. And that's the whole point, really, with our cleanups is that we want to ensure protectiveness of human health and the environment. So what if you're in that situation where it's not protective and you have to do something? Well, when you have a follow-up action from your five-year review, for example, that the remedy is not protective based on that five-year review, then recommendations should be added to address protectiveness. That's step one. Your five-year review should have those recommendations and follow-up actions that need to be conducted. But to take it one step further, if the five-year review determines that the remedy is not performing as designed, or you know, it's just not protective in its current state, then you might also have to consider not just those follow-up actions, but an actual change to the remedy through an ESD or a ROD amendment. You cannot change your remedy in your five-year review document. The decision document itself would need to be updated appropriately if it's to address an issue of protectiveness. So some follow-up actions don't require changing your remedy, right? Like, oh, the no trespassing signs are down. They need to be replaced and better situated. Okay, that's not a change to your remedy. But if a cleanup level has changed and your excavation didn't dig down deep enough to remove all the waste material that actually poses a threat, well, then you have to go back and reconsider. Maybe your cap is fine, or maybe additional excavation would be needed. That's where you have to have that conversation as far as a potential change to the remedy. So we have one last supplier understanding slide on the five-year review topic. So Jean, if you want to take us through this scenario.
Sure. So there's a potential situation that's been put up on the screen where Site A is preparing for its second five-year review, where it had a ROD that was issued in 2005. However, the cleanup level for the primary contaminant of concern became more stringent in 2012, and so based on this new cleanup level, the existing COC concentrations are exceeding the cleanup level. Because the remedy is still performing as designed and the RAOs were met, and therefore the institutional controls are no longer in place, the other federal agency concludes that this remedy is still protective. And so the question is that a true or false statement? Is that remedy still protective? You'll have a box on the bottom half of your screen where you can vote either true or false. And I'll give you all just a few more seconds here to go ahead and chime in with your responses before I lock it down. So given all of that information, is this remedy still protective, true or false? I'm going to go ahead and lock the answers down. And it looks like about 80% of the audience thought that that is a false statement. What's the right response?
So if you said that is false, then you would be correct. That is a false statement. If the remedy can't meet the new cleanup level and the previous one is outside of the risk range, then you are not protective with that remedy. So the five-year review in this case could recommend that a new cleanup level, or based on the standard, be adopted in the decision document, and then it could be determined if it's necessary to actually modify the remedy from that point. So you start with a recommendation in the five-year review and then follow up in the decision document as needed. All right, so the five-year review was our last topic for today's webinar. We've been gone over removal actions, interim rods, final rods, and how we've considered adaptive management and five-year reviews in that process, as well as times when you have to change your record of decision through an ESD or a ROD amendment. So that was the meat of today's conversation. I think we have a little bit of time for additional questions.
We do indeed.
We had some come in.
Yes, oh, we have plenty of them. So let me jump right into this question about five-year reviews. Somebody wanted to know, does the five-year review clock reset if the original ROD is amended?
I'll have to check with Monica McKeady. She's our five-year review contact for federal facilities. Since the clock starts when your remedial action is initiated, if you issue a new decision document, I don't assume that means that you get a restart of the clock unless you are actually doing a ROD amendment that, you know, is implementing a whole new portion of the remedial action. I'll have to double check. I think unless it's a major change, the clock would remain the same unless you have to go through another construction phase. Mary, do you have?
No, that would be my understanding. I mean, unless you're going through that whole RA process again, the clock would remain the same.
Okay. All right. One of the participants wanted to know, out of all of the reports that have been discussed in today's webinar, which of them should be sent to FIFRO for review?
So consultations at FIFRO for decision documents at federal facility sites really lend to the topic itself. So if you have PFAS at your site, there's a consultation. If you have lead at your federal facility site, you should be coming to FIFRO. If you are dealing with some kind of precedent-setting issue, we'd like to look at that. If you have a complex groundwater remedy, we would like to look at that as well. And there actually is a recent memo where we identify all the, or I guess I would say, the highest ranking instances when we would appreciate that those documents come to us for review. We can maybe add that to the notes or to the URL page, Jean, that really lays out all the times we are going to want to review a decision document. Because that those are just a few. Also, if you are dealing with RADs at your site, we likely want to look at that. The list is a bit long.
Yes, the one thing that should also be considered here is for RADs. There are some EPA regions who have been through a process where they don't, because their RADs are very consistent, don't necessarily go to headquarters for federal facilities to be reviewed, even though that would be different on the private side of the house. But that's not for all regions, so it depends on the region you're in whether your RADs would come in for review. When it comes, Emmy hit it, when it comes to if you're doing something precedent setting or that you really would like that input from headquarters because you have a complex groundwater issue or something like that, feel free to utilize us as a tool.
I did forget to mention with the administrator bringing back delegation to those decisions that are $50 million or more in cost. Anything that's coming to the EPA administrator's office, if it's for a federal facility site, our office, FIFRA, will be reviewing as well.
Okay, great. We had a few questions that came in about emerging contaminants. So I'm just going to ask, I know that this isn't five-year review training, but they just wanted to know, should you be looking at emerging contaminants like PFAS when you're doing your five-year review?
So the short answer to that is, but it depends on the applicable unit. It depends on what your contaminants are. So if you're doing a five-year review on a fire training area, and you know they used AFFF, sure, it would be reasonably anticipated that you would be looking for PFAS at that site. But that doesn't hold true for every operable unit. Not every site that we look at, there would be that connection to PFAS, but where you would expect to find it, if it's tied in with that remedy, or could impact that remedy, that may be something you want to look into. Because remember, we're looking at changes in exposure assumptions during the five-year review. So tox data, cleanup levels, new information. So all those things are something to consider. And there's another five-year review, more in-depth conversation during the five-year review training itself.
Okay, great. Now, what about the case where we have an emerging contaminant that's been identified, but risk is below that from the original ROD COCs? So this is somewhat related to an example you all just covered. Would, if that's happening, is a protective determination appropriate? In other words, you find a new contaminant, but the risk is below that from the ROD's original contaminant of concern. So is that still a protective determination situation?
I think that's probably going to be a site-specific determination. We'd probably want to know the details of that before we'd make a statement on that.
Okay. All right. Let's take a look at this question about state involvement. If the state wants the lead agency to amend a ROD, what is the process? Are there criteria that need to be met in order to trigger this?
So hopefully at our federal facility sites, there is a team effort between the lead agency and the regulatory agencies. So if you're in a situation where the state thinks a record of decision needs to be amended, but the lead agency does not agree, then that's going to be difficult. It's much easier when all parties are in agreement and moving forward. So if you're looking at a record of decision, what is the need for the change? Is it not functioning as intended? Is it no longer protective? Is it something that's addressing an unacceptable risk as defined by the circle of risk range? Or is it just an additional action that the state wants to see the lead agency implement? So there's a lot of questions I would have before being able to answer that, but I think I would just sum it up high level by saying, ideally, your site teams are working together to identify when those changes are needed.
All right, great. One participant has asked, would a change in the time frame to achieve your cleanup levels be considered a significant change?
If you are changing your remedial action objectives, that's a very big change. What do you think, Mary?
I would agree. If you're changing your timeline, if you're shortening it, I don't know that I'd call it that. I'd call it a win. I don't know that I'd call it all that significant. If you're extending it, there's the question as to whether that's fundamental. You're fundamentally changing the REOs. You're changing your timeline significantly. My understanding of a ROD amendment is that that would fall under that.
Yeah, I think it gets back to performance.
Like I said, yeah, and if you're shortening it, that's a plus. Would that be? I don't know that I'd even go so far as to say that would even be a significant change. Although, you still would want to document that. Hey, we now think this is going to take us 10 years instead of 50.
Okay. Let's see if we can question about ARARs. One of the attendees wanted to confirm if the ARARs are frozen at ROD signature.
We essentially do use that language when you sign a record of decision. The ARARs identified in that record of decision are what our work to as far as enforcing the implementation of the remedy. You heard Mary mention opening the ROD. Like, sometimes there's a lot of hesitation around amending a record of decision because you are opening up the entire ROD, including the ARARs would apply, given you are changing your remedial alternative in some way, right? So you would reconsider ARARs. So I would say, yes, the ARARs identified in the record of decision when signed are where the enforceability lies. If you're moving forward, though, new information comes to light that really shows there's a new cleanup standard or something else needs to be applied in order for that remedy to be protective, then that's a different conversation, and it would make sense to go back and change the remedy as needed to ensure that that number one protectiveness criteria is met.
Right. We run into this conversation. We have this conversation on ROD's all the time because it is one of those issues. It's new information that's come to light during the ROD when we're analyzing at the five-year review period.
Okay, we are about 2 minutes until 3 p.m., our scheduled end time. We do have a number of very site-specific questions that were still left in the queue. So why don't we move on to that last slide and talk about what someone can do if they have questions that either weren't addressed or perhaps had a site-specific situation that they wanted to get your input on.
Sure. So as you can see on the slide, this is our contact information. You have Mary Cook's information listed first, and this Emerald Laiha. We have our numbers and our emails. I think we would be more than willing to entertain questions that you may have. We are always hesitant, though, to caveat that we cannot answer site-specific questions for the region. We can, give you some information or point you to appropriate documents, but we definitely want to respect the role that our EPA regions play in these site-specific conversations and decisions, but we also want the help. So if we can help provide information that will be useful in your discussions, I think we'd be happy to do that. Mary, do you have other thoughts?
No, I 100% agree. We try not to get involved with the site-specific conversations. those determinations are made at the regional level. We tend to get more involved in the policy, but we are definitely available to help anybody who needs to be guided to the right place, or if you have a tough conversation you want to have, you know, we're willing, you know, we can definitely set up that call. And we can answer as best we can any of the policy questions that come out of today's conversation. One thing I do want to point out, though, is my contact information is slightly off. The area code's 202. I don't know who's at 205, but they might be really excited to get a question about PFAS. But you know, a lot of these site-specific questions that are here that I'm looking at with these emerging contaminants, I mean, by definition, emerging contaminants are emerging. They're different. There's new information. I don't have specifics on any of these, but to, you know, if your emerging contaminant is something that's, the reason it's emerging is because there is a change in something that may be treated very differently than if it's something we don't have necessarily an AR for or a federally promulgated number. So those discussions, again, should be happening with your teams at the site level or with the regions if there's some concern. But again, we are always willing to have those conversations.
Okay. Well, with those final reminders for the audience, I wanted to walk through a few quick closing comments before we wrap up today's live broadcast. So I'll ask you all just to hang tight with us for about one more minute while I walk through a few final reminders, and then we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. So as we highlighted at the start of this, this is part of an ongoing series. We'll carry on with session number 4 that'll take place next month on December 2nd, where the topic will be coordinating with tribes at federal facilities. Now, the previous two sessions, the first two ones in the series, are already available. You can find those on the Public Clue and Archive. We'll have today's session, which was the third in the series, available for on-demand playback in about a week, and you will automatically get an email once that archive is available. And yes, you can still get a certificate if you play back the recorded version or get credit for replaying the recorded version. So let's talk a little bit about that in the process. So for those of you looking for copies of the presentation material, we do have the participant manual, which has the slides and reference materials posted on the resources or links page, along with a number of the documents that were highlighted in today's session. You'll find that on the middle right of the screen under related URLs. You can scroll through that list, click on the one seminar resources, and then press the browse to button to open it up. If you're watching the recorded version of the webinar, you can still follow those links under related URLs. I've also pasted in the Q&A window on the lower right for quick reference. Contact information was listed in the presentation content. You'll also find it on the seminar homepage. And I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form. Now, remember that this is part of an ongoing series. So in order to get credit, you need to participate in the event for any of the 11 webinars, either online live or to replay the recorded version. And you'll need to submit feedback for each one of those sessions, whether you were there live or you replay the recorded version. In order to get a certificate or get credit, you have to fill out feedback for the session. If you're going to take the in-person training that will take place later on, that will happen in person. Additional details will be sent to you later on. So for my purposes for today, this is how to get certificates for today's session. You're going to want to fill out the online feedback form for today's session. Again, it's under related URLs. You can browse to that link and open it up. If you fill out that form, please be sure to check the box at the bottom of the form that certifies you were here for the whole session or you replayed the entire recording. Even if you're replaying today's session, you still follow the link to the feedback form and fill that out, checking out that box. As soon as you do, you'll then immediately have access to a certificate of participation that you can either save or print out for your own records. For those of you that participated in a group in a conference room, each person in that room can fill out the form on their own, whether they registered individually or not. You'll simply need to get the link to the feedback form from the person who signed up and sort of set up the viewing room at your location, and then you can each fill it out to get your own certificate individually, again, whether you registered on your own or not. So please be sure to submit feedback for each one of the sessions in the series and keep track. We have included a session tracker. It's an Excel spreadsheet in the resources that you can use to individually keep track of the sessions that you either attend live or replay for via the recorded version just for your own records. So with that, I want to thank the nearly 250 people who joined us for today's live broadcast. We will hopefully see you all next month when we carry on with this series. And I want to thank our organizers and speakers who took time out of their busy days to help us put on today's session. We'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for